Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Lawmakers in Congress are pressing President Bush to explain how the U.S. will complete its mission in Iraq. This morning, the Republican-controlled Senate voted down a proposal from Democrats which demanded that President Bush outline a timetable for a withdrawal. A Republican-backed alternative, lacking a timetable but calling for the year 2006 to be a significant transition to complete Iraqi authority, did pass. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist called the failed Democratic proposal a cut-and-run strategy, and he insisted that the Republican measure, which again did pass, is not linked to dwindling public support for the war.
Mr. President, the Republican amendment is not a change in policy. It's not a change in tone, as has been suggested on the floor. Our amendment reflects where this body has always been, supportive of the president and supportive of our troops overseas.
So a lot of activity in Congress today. Joining us on the line is Gail Chadwick. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, first of all, could you tell us a little more about this Republican measure which did pass today, calling for 2006 to be a significant transition year?
Well, it's interesting that the Republican amendment and the Democratic amendment were very, very similar, and that was deliberate. Armed Services Chairman Warner of Virginia wanted to send a message to the White House that there is considerable agreement in the Congress that there needs to be a change, that more needs to be done in terms of congressional oversight and reporting.
So what do we, I just want to interrupt you for a second to say, what do we make of Bill Frist's comment that this is not a change in policy or tone?
He didn't get the memo. That is, there really is a shift, especially among members of the Armed Services Committee, on how much oversight ought to be conducted. Now, they agree on many points. Senators Frist and Warner are in complete agreement that there shouldn't be even the suggestion of a timetable, and that was the main difference between the Democratic and Republican amendments. However, Warner's people were saying today, and he said himself on the floor, this is a change. It's the first significant amendment on, you know, curbing the executive's control of the war, demanding more information from them since the war was voted 3 years ago. So I would respectfully disagree with the way the majority leader characterized the feeling within his own caucus. The other thing I think is very interesting is they both, Senators Warner and the Republicans that supported this amendment, and Senator Frist are using the same phrase, cut and run. Senator Frist added that the Republicans have a victory strategy, not a cut and run strategy. And that is something on which Republicans are in complete agreement.
Is that really going to fly, though, with the electorate? Because, as you said, really the only difference between the two amendments was the Democrats were calling for a timetable. Some would say that a timetable is a dangerous thing to put in. Insurgents can then just wait out the timetable.
That's right.
But that seems to be the only difference. So why aren't the Republicans also cutting and running if they're talking about leaving in 2006 as well?
Because of the language they're using, they're not requiring, for example, what Democrats wanted to see was the White House to lay out strategic goals on the ground. How many forces would be necessary to be trained by what deadline? And if that deadline was met, then a certain number of American troops would leave. That's what Senator Warner did not want to see. There was also an interesting disagreement over how much of the report should be classified. There's now a requirement that the White House regularly report to the Senate on progress in the war. The Democrats wanted that unclassified, and the Republicans have left open that portions of it could be kept classified. Mm.
Gail, a lot of hubbub on the Hill, voting before noon in one occasion, which is unusual. Why? What do you think is prompting this quick action?
Members have gone back to their districts, and they're hearing what we're reading in the polls, that the American public is now very solidly opposed to this war. And that they want the Senate to do something, to exert some oversight. And as Senator Warner said today, this is as close to unity as the Senate can come. It was an amendment that was deliberately crafted to get a big vote. Now, before the vote, Republicans were saying that Senator Warner's people were saying they could get as many as 90 votes. In the end, they only got 79. But it is an effort to address the very real concerns of their constituents, that the war is going badly and the Senate is doing nothing.
Well, what happens to this proposal now? Is it attached to some other bill? And how effective might it be, and how real might it become?
Well, it's attached to a defense appropriations bill. It is, given the size of that vote, it's very likely to arrive at the president's desk. Now, there may be some effort to derail it in the House, but Senate sentiment for this is very strong. I think that they're going to have difficulty knocking this out.
We understand that the Senate Democrats, although, as you point out, the House is also Republican-controlled, but Senate Democrats are also pushing for the same debate and kind of vote tomorrow.
Yes.
Well, Gail Chadwick, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, on a very busy day where the Senate is sending a message to the president, and you seem to be standing right in the thick of it. Gail, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Meanwhile, President Bush is out of town. He's on friendlier territory today as he begins a whirlwind 8-day tour of Asia and begins in Japan. The president will meet there with his close ally, Japanese Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi, an early and steadfast supporter of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The president will address young leaders in Japan on Wednesday about the power of democracy, but his words will be aimed at a later stop on his itinerary, China. While power in China remains in the hands of the Communist Party, the country has made big changes. But we turn now to a cautionary tale in this age of globalization. It's about sports, politics, and big business. It's also about the delicate relationship between East and West. It's about the Chinese NBA basketball star Yao Ming. Yao Ming, a 7-foot-6-inch center for the Houston Rockets, is, in the most unpersonal terms, a product. He was created by the Chinese government and American business interests. While both had the same goal, creating an international superstar athlete, the Chinese sports machine would ultimately collide with American capitalism, and that tension remains, even though Yao Ming has turned into an all-star player in the NBA. Yao Ming's story, which in a way is also the story of the last 100 years in China, is the subject of a new book, Operation Yao Ming, The Chinese Sports Empire, American Big Business, and the Making of an NBA Superstar. Author Brooke Larmer, a former Shanghai bureau chief for Newsweek magazine, wrote it, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's explain the title first, Operation Yao Ming. Who were some of the players?
Operation Yao Ming actually refers to two operations. One was from the Chinese side, where the Chinese sports system was developed in the early years of Chairman Mao after the revolution in order to raise up what was considered in Asia the weak man of Asia, China, which had been trampled politically and had been humiliated on the athletic stage. So they created this sports system. Even back then, there was Yao Ming's grandfather was identified by a local coach in Shanghai. He was 6'8". But it wasn't until his son, Yao's father, was born that or came into adolescence that he was recruited into the sports system. Yao's mother was also recruited into the sports system. And eventually, when they retired, they were strongly encouraged to get together and gave birth to Yao Ming.
Well, let's stop there because that's what becomes amazing. We'll get to the other players, the U.S. side, in a minute. But his parents were literally told by, again, this Soviet-style sports machine in China, listen, you two are very tall. We want you to hook up because we're hoping you'll produce a superstar.
Yeah, you have to put it into the context of China. China at that point was very poor. Arranged marriages were actually quite common. And within their work unit, and for them this was the sports authorities within China, it was very common for coaches and administrators to give suggestions to their players when they retired. And this was at age 28, which was quite late for most Chinese at that right. time to get married.
But so still, it smacks of eugenics.
You could call it a passive form of eugenics, yes. Right. I mean, certainly when Yao Ming was born, everybody knew that something special was on its way. He actually himself referred many years later to his childhood and says, from the day I was born, I was reserved.
Reserved because he started to grow, just as the sports officials hoped when they matched up his tall basketball-playing parents. At age 8, he was already 5'7", and you write that the Chinese sports officials came to get him, and they said to his mom and dad, we can't wait any longer, he has to come with us. His parents had not had a good experience in the Chinese sports system, but they felt obligated to give him up. And for his part, Yao didn't want to go. He didn't like the game. He didn't have a knack for it. He didn't have much stamina. His coordination couldn't keep up with his rapid growth. In fact, you write that Yao Ming really wanted to be an archaeologist.
Right. I mean, as a young child, his only talent really was his size. But for the children going into the system, it wasn't necessarily seen as being forced. Everything in China was the same system. This was... It's simply that this system has persisted until today. The work units for the basketball players was not so different from the work units at the factories. So when they worked 6 to 8 hours a day, especially trying to show that revolutionary spirit, it didn't seem so unusual in the context of Chinese society. For many parents at that time also, this gave them three square meals a day.
Yeah.
And so that it was looked at as a positive thing by some, almost as though it were joining the military.
In fact, meal tickets, ration tickets, were sometimes used as inspiration to get these kids to play more. You'll get more food.
That's right. Food was a huge motivating factor.
It's wild. Well, your book is really the story of two tall Chinese players. Yao Ming was one. Wang Zhizhi was the other. He was about 3 years older than Yao. He made it to the NBA first. He also came from tall stock, but he didn't fare as well.
He actually was in China, the best-known player in China. He sprouted very young. He was 6 feet nine at the age of 13, and he became the star of the People's Liberation Army team, which was the strongest team in China. They have a long tradition in the Communist Army to excel in sports, and he was the epitome of this. He led them to 6 straight national titles and also the Chinese team to the Olympics. So he was much more famous than Yao inside China. But when he made the leap and to the NBA in 2001, and at that time, he was a national hero. Mm. He was considered an ambassador from China to the United States just on the eve of the vote for the Beijing Olympics in 2008. So it was almost a goodwill gesture to show to the world that China wanted to participate in this grand world event.
But he then took the misstep of saying that he wanted his child to be born an American and he wanted to get a passport and a green card, and they literally cut him off.
He had a difficult decision to make. At the end of his second season, he thought and feared that his NBA career might be over if he went back to China because his contract was running out with the Dallas Mavericks. The Army had not given him approval or a sign that he could continue. And he knew that he felt that he needed to go to the NBA Summer League to prove himself and to get a new contract. That individual decision, that choice to take his own destiny into his own hands, rubbed the authorities in China the wrong way. It created a huge mess on the eve of the draft that was supposed to pick Yao Ming, his longtime rival, to go to the NBA. So that small step led to an almost inevitable split with the Chinese government, in which he is considered now a pariah in his homeland.
Author Brooke Larmer speaking about his new book, Operation Yao Ming, The Chinese Sports Empire, American Big Business, and the Making of an NBA Superstar. After the break, we'll hear the American side of the story and find out why Nike and the NBA were so interested in Yao Ming and Wang Zhizhi. By the way, we began our program with news that the Senate has just passed a resolution calling for 2006 to be a year in which Iraq gains more sovereignty and presumably U.S. troops begin to leave the country. I said that the Senate would consider the same issue tomorrow. Of course, I meant the House. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Here and now. Basketball star Yao Ming is probably the most famous living Chinese person on earth. And today we're talking about his journey from Shanghai to the NBA with author Brooke Larmer, whose book is called Operation Yao Ming. And Brooke, Yao Ming is very much, as we said, a product of the Chinese sports system. But you write he's also a creation of Nike and the NBA. Nike, of course, wanting sneakers on every one of those Chinese feet.
That's right. I mean, they looked for local heroes that could do for Nike or the NBA what Michael Jordan had done in the rest of the world. And Yao Ming and Wang Zhizhi stood above the rest as a potential NBA player. So they both locked in on these two players and tried to expose them to Western sporting mores and to bring them out, and also had to do this. They had to develop relationships not just with the boys and their families, but also with the Chinese sports system, which was much more difficult.
Right, and you describe a great scene where NBA Commissioner David Stern arrives at the offices of China State Television. And they clearly don't really care about it. They're not impressed. And he's used to having people be impressed.
That's right. At that point, it was 1990, his first trip to China. He was one of the most powerful sports personalities in the world. And he rolls up to the CCTV headquarters, which is a state TV monopoly. And not only was there no red carpet, but nobody was there to receive him, and nobody even knew who he was. He had to cool his heels down in the lobby for several hours before a low-level apparatchik came down and explained to him that Mr. Stern, in China at that point, TV was meant to ennoble the masses, not to entertain them. Mm-hmm. So it was a few years before the NBA actually started rolling, but that was kind of the first icebreaker. But on all of these encounters between the East and the West, there's a huge gap in business culture where Nike and the NBA, coming from a hyper-capitalistic world, try to encounter this ambitious, growing Chinese market that is still, in many ways, especially in the sports system, locked back in that old socialist mentality.
Well, and you tell us why, and it's obvious why, American businesses and the NBA would be interested in bringing basketball to this huge country. Now explain what China has at stake with Yao Ming, because, again, he's in the center of these two competing forces. It sort of tells us the history of sport in China, because at one time, you know, Chinese athletes weren't even allowed to win in international competition because it was seen as being, you know, bad for public relations. Tell us how Yao Ming illustrated the Chinese needs.
Yao Ming actually perfectly demonstrates the changing desires of the Chinese people and the Chinese government. 30 years ago, at the end of the Cultural Revolution, as you say, at that point it was called friendship first. If they had any foreign competition, it was in order to make friends. When Chairman Mao died and Deng Xiaoping took over, at that point, China really didn't just want to rejoin the world. They wanted to compete as equals. And that's when they first rejoined the Olympic movement. If you recall, their first re-entry into the Olympics was 1984, just 21 years ago.
A lot of people might remember. Wasn't that Los Angeles?
That was Los Angeles.
And the triumphant entering the stadium. And
that's right. There was the Soviet boycott of that Olympics, but Peter Ubaroth, who organized the L.A. Olympics, was just incredibly grateful to the Chinese for having broken that boycott by coming themselves. It was their first triumphant entry. They didn't win that many medals. But in the 20 years since then, they have kind of climbed the medals ladder until in Athens last year, they won 32 gold medals compared to the United States, 35. And when the Olympics go to Beijing in 2008, they are determined to come out number one.
And Yao Ming is a part of this how? Because he plays for an American team. So how does he fulfill the needs of the Chinese?
It's very complicated, this relationship. But for Yao Ming as an individual, number one, he feels great loyalty to the Chinese, to China in general, but also to the authorities that raised him. He feels like he does owe the state something. On the other hand, unlike his former rival and sometime friend Wang Zhijie, he is able to maintain these commercial relationships. And you can bet that if he did not have a good relationship with China, would McDonald's, Pepsi, Gatorade, Apple Computer, would they be pounding at his door? It would be very difficult for them to want to do that if he didn't actually give them access to the Chinese market. So It's a commercial thing as well. But yes, when he goes back to China, he feels somewhat sheepish about his wealth. His national team players don't have that money. So when he actually goes to practice, he will cramp himself into these little minivans to go to practice just like everyone else. He doesn't want any special treatment.
Well, you mentioned special treatment, and I wonder if the Chinese sports officials are wondering nervously how you're going to keep them down on the farm, because the Chinese sports machine, as you described it, really hasn't changed that much.
The sports system is changing gradually, and one of the ways in which it is that they're trying to introduce education more rigorously into the sports schools, because unless they're Yao Ming and are going to be breaking through and making these tens of millions of dollars, there's not a lot of future for a failed athlete, especially if you have no education. What China is now is it has a wealth of opportunities for people who are educated. But as you point out, I mean, this, even though their sports system has created these symbols of China's modern advancement, everyone is proud of Yao Ming and the gold medalist as a sign that China is now strong again. These symbols are actually the products of one of the last bastions of state socialism in China. And the reformers within the system had bittersweet feelings when China won the 2008 Olympics, because on one hand, of course they're proud. This is a great moment for China. But on the other hand, they may not see any reforms within the system or any serious reforms that give individual athletes the freedom to make choices in their lives until well after 2008.
Mm. And what about Yao Ming, Brooke Larmer? The one moment of joy related to basketball that I pick up in the book is when, as a younger person, he sees the Harlem Globetrotters who have come to China, and he thinks, wow, this could be fun. He didn't have a lot of fun with basketball. How would you describe him now, this person upon whom so many people have placed their expectations?
There is something that's sad about his case, even though he is a multi-millionaire. And one of the reasons I focus this book not just on him but on Wang Zhejie is that he's really the bright shining bridge between East and West. Wang, for his decision to stay and for a decision to upset the Chinese government, is stuck in the chasm between East and West. And back in China, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of athletes who don't reach the level of either of these players. And when they don't succeed, that, I think, is a greater tragedy than either of these players.
Fascinating reading. Again, the book, Operation Yao Ming. Brooke, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Stay with us after the news. That confusing Medicare prescription plan, that's coming up here and now. Funding for Hearing, it's here and now. And today is the first day that seniors across the country can enroll in the federal government's much-touted new Medicare prescription drug benefit. The benefit is the largest expansion of the Medicare program since it was created in 1965. Michael Levitt, Secretary of Health and Human Services, says the drug plan will provide a safety net for people.
Never again will a senior have to worry about having their savings eroded because of prescription drugs.
But first, they have to figure it out. The new Medicare drug program is very confusing. In most states, seniors have to wade through more than 40 different health plans to decide whether to go with the new benefit or keep drug coverage they may already have. We're joined on the line by Marian Aspinall. She's director of the SHINE program for the Massachusetts Executive Office of Elder Affairs. And Marian, we understand SHINE stands for Serving the Health Information Need of Elders. You're telling elders across Massachusetts about their options. We presume that's happening in other states as well. In a nutshell, how do you start?
What we do is we have them list all their medications so we can look and see what they're taking. We ask what kind of insurance they have now. If they belong to a Medicare HMO, then they need to go to their HMO to sign up for a plan. They may have an employer plan that is creditable coverage, which means it's as good as Medicare Part D, and they don't have to do anything. Mm. If they don't have creditable coverage or they have no coverage, then we would go into the web, www.medicare.gov, and there's a tool in there, and we can list all their information, and that will print out the plans that will cover their medications. We'll be good at the pharmacies that they use, and it will give us the cost.
And by the way, we have also gone to that website today, and we'll link to it on our website. But a warning, it's really crowded today. It's hard to...
First day, it's very busy,
yeah. It's hard to get on it. But basically, for instance, in New York, seniors have 46 plans to sort through, and the premiums that they have to pay range from $4 to $80 a month, again, depending on how healthy they are, how many meds they need. Most of the plans require you to pick up the full tab once drug costs hit $2,250. And I'm wondering, in Massachusetts, is it about the same, or are all the plans nationwide about the same, that you have to pay about half of the cost of your prescriptions?
Some of them you do and some of them you don't. For a lot of people, there's the low-income subsidy, which is extra help. And they can apply for that through Social Security, and that will pick up some of those costs for them.
And tell us, you say you ask them what medications they take. What does that matter? I mean, how do the plans relate to how many medications you take?
Each plan has a formulary which lists all the drugs that they cover. They must cover at least two drugs in each class. Mm-hmm. However, it may not be the name of the drug the individual is taking. They may take a drug for cholesterol, say Lipitor, and that's not on the formulary. But there is another drug for cholesterol that's on the formulary.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be that they have to get a new script from their physician if they want that particular plan.
What are you hearing from seniors? Do they understand their options? Do they understand the plans? Are they signing up? Are they wanting to sign up?
Well, today's the first day to sign up, and they have a lot of questions. Will my drugs be covered? Can I go to my local pharmacy? How much is this going to cost me? There's a lot of information, so we're very busy doing one-on-one counseling, assisting the seniors with the different options.
Well, some people are saying that this is a great deal for the insurance companies because they're getting government subsidies and they have this new customer base of 44 million seniors to look at. But are you concerned that there are 1,300 health plans nationwide and some are worried that just like the Medicare managed care plans, they couldn't sustain the market of seniors, that some of these private plans are just going to go out of business and leave some of the people you're talking to today out in the cold? Are you worried about that, or are any of the seniors worried about that?
No, I don't think they are. We haven't heard that. They're very interested in the plan. Is it going to work for them? And they have a lot of questions. You know, as I said, are my drugs covered? How much is this going to cost me? But pretty much, I think they're pretty open to what's going to happen.
What is the risk for the customers? I mean, what is the risk for the seniors? We know that some are worried that while there may be low costs right now, those costs may go up. Is it possible that the costs might change?
Anything's possible. The formularies can change. The premiums can change. And we just have to wait and see what happens. But for the seniors, I believe it's a great benefit because we have many who do not have coverage for medication. So this is a low-cost option for them.
What is the average monthly premium, Marion, that you're seeing?
The average in Massachusetts is about $37. However, we have plans as low as $7 and up to about $80 a month.
What is the biggest question that seniors are asking you?
The biggest question is, are my drugs going to be covered?
And
how much this is going to cost me?
And the answer varies.
And the answer varies on the formulary and the plan.
We understand that the poorest seniors who are on Medicaid health insurance are forced onto the new Medicare program. It's not an option for them. And so they lose their Medicaid and they go into this new unproven territory. Are you at all concerned? Are you hearing concerns from these seniors on Medicaid that they might ultimately end up without any prescription drug benefits if these new plans fail?
I haven't heard anything, truthfully. I think that for those people who are going to be automatically enrolled into a plan, the people who are on Medicaid and the people who are on the state prescription assistance program, Prescription Advantage here in Massachusetts, we're going to be sitting down with those people who are automatically enrolled to make sure that the plan they've been enrolled in is appropriate to the medications that they take.
You know, Marion, you're doing very hard work trying to spread the news about the new Medicare program. Do you find yourself wondering, why wasn't it simpler? I mean, it's just, I've gone online and it's really tough to wade through.
There's a lot of information. That's why we're here. We have 450 counselors throughout the state of Massachusetts. They've all been trained and they have all the tools they need to assist the beneficiaries. And there is a lot of information, but we're helping them wade through all that.
You're very diplomatic, Marion. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Marion Aspinall is director of the SHINE program for the Massachusetts Executive Office of Elder Affairs, crisscrossing the state today to help seniors with the new Medicare prescription drug benefit program. And these additional notes about the new Medicare drug benefit, it's expected to cost the federal government $720 billion over the next 10 years. The current enrollment period extends through May 15th. If you don't sign up by then, as we indicated, you may have to pay more for the benefit. And if you sign up by the end of the year, coverage begins January 1st. Again, for more, go to our website, here-now.org. And when you get there and you wrestle with your or your parents' prescription plan, we have more news about another aspect of retirement. The federal agency that insures the private pensions of 44 million workers has announced that its deficit is almost $23 billion. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation disclosed in its annual financial report that it had $56 billion in assets to cover $79 billion in pension liabilities. That deficit is the result of a number of big ailing companies transferring their pension liabilities to the PBGC. In recent years, Polaroid, Bethlehem Steel, Kaiser Aluminum, United Airlines, and Huffy Bicycles have ended their pension plans and transferred responsibility to the federal government. You're listening to Here and Now. Does your town have a river running through it? Well, you might consider a river sing. Here in Massachusetts, the Charles River separates Boston and Cambridge, and now both sides have a new tradition, bridging the cities with song. Coordinated by the performance group Revels and the Charles River Conservancy, featuring groups like the Swiss Alp Horns and the Second Line Social Aid and Pleasure Society Brass Band, thousands recently flocked to the banks on each side to sing back and forth and celebrate autumn. Here are some of the sounds of this year's River Sing.
The weather is absolutely glorious. This is a great day to welcome fall. This is the moment of balance in the year, and I think that being on either side of the river sort of encapsulates that sense of balance, but it's also the beginning of the dark. Things are going to be getting a lot darker a lot quicker, so it's an important time to bring light to each other by singing together.
Basically, we're singing familiar songs. We're starting off in hymns and spirituals. We're starting off with Shall We Gather at the River. We're doing Shenandoah, Wade in the Water, great old spiritual. Deep River is another one. And we're dividing them up. It's in the program, so everybody knows when to sing. One side sings and the other sings back.
We were doing call and response. The Boston side sings, and then the Cambridge side sings back. So we were communicating. Actually, African-American people did a lot of call and response during the days of slavery and before in Africa.
Using it as a uniting device. Everybody sees it as the Boston side or the Cambridge side, but in fact, we're speaking to each other, we're creating a musical dialogue and a social dialogue across the river.
I'm gonna lay down my sword shield
down by the riverside, down by the riverside.
My name is Solaris, and I am one of the river goddesses. My sister Aluna is across the way, and my brother Oshun will someday rise.
We're just here to see the show. I'm here to hear the music.
Maybe I sing well, maybe I won't.
When I was looking over the bridge, and everybody's all singing together, and there's the beautiful river, and everybody's directing, and everyone is acting as one. And it was very nice. I mean, it was just a really pretty thing, as an introduction to fall, or as it's just a nice night.
Our band, the Second Line Social Aid and Pleasure Society, we were here last year. It's really cool with the equinox and fall starting and the boats in the river and the sun setting. Really beautiful. All the different types of music. It's cool. It's nice.
it was a great opportunity for us to not only observe the time of year, which is a wonderful turning of the year moment, but it's also a great way of celebrating the river, which is such a great resource for Boston and Cambridge. And it's also, for me, a great opportunity to get people together to sing, because I love people singing together, great mobs of people.
That's Alan Casso of the Cambridge, Massachusetts-based Revels at this year's River Sing. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. Young, it's Here and Now, and as we reported earlier in the program, the U.S. Senate sent a strong message to President Bush today about the war in Iraq. Senators voted 79-19 in favor of a Republican amendment calling for 2006 to be a year of significant transition so that Iraqi troops can take over control and American troops can start returning home. Senators rejected a proposal from Democrats to set estimated timetables for withdrawal. Well, joining us now from Capitol Hill is Senator John Kerry, Democrat from Massachusetts. Of course, he ran for president last year and was pointedly mentioned in a Veterans Day speech by President Bush as a Democrat who early on supported the war. We want to talk about that. But first of all, Senator Kerry, welcome.
Hello, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. And we understand that the Democratic measure that failed called for a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. That seems to be the biggest difference between your measure and the Republican measure that passed. Why a timetable?
It didn't call for a timetable specifically for the withdrawal of troops. What it called for was a timetable for specific benchmarks of accomplishment, those benchmarks being the key to the withdrawal of troops. And the fact is that the Republican proposal basically said we'll stay as long as it takes, which is the same policy that you have today. Taking as long as it takes gives the Iraqis the ability to determine exactly how long it's going to be. And I think we have to have a tougher line to transition their troops into a greater level of responsibility and assumption of the risks.
Well, we heard earlier from Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor that the Republican proposal called for 2006 to be a significant period of transition, in other words, to really begin the withdrawal. First of all, did you vote for the Republican measure?
No, I did not vote for the Republican measure because the Republican measure does not tie any of the benchmarks to the concept of actually withdrawing American troops. It leaves open how many American troops would be over there for how long. It specifically does not say that the United States should inform the Iraqis. We're not going to be there inevitably. It leaves completely open-ended that, and I think it's wrong to do that. I think that that creates sort of a prolongation, if you will, of the assumption of responsibility. General Casey, former Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird to Richard Nixon, other people have all said that the presence of American troops in large numbers in their current deployment actually prolongs the longer American dependency.
But Senator Kerry, the vote was 79-19, so obviously many of your fellow Democrats did vote for it, and we're understanding that.
Well, I don't agree with them. I'm proud that I voted against it because I don't think it's as specific as our amendment was. Our amendment said that number one, we're not going to be there indefinitely, and number two, it makes it clear that you have to have these benchmarks for accomplishment and that we could begin to withdraw some troops based on that. The Republican one doesn't really want to mention the withdrawal tied to any kind of benchmarks, and I think that's a mistake.
Well, many Republicans, Senator Warner for one, are saying that they think this sent a really clear message to the president that they are unsettled by criticism of the intelligence leading up to the war. And I want to ask you about that because, as you all know, President Bush singled you out in his Veterans Day speech as somebody who was an early supporter of the war and saw the same intelligence that the White House did. How do you respond to that?
We did not see the same intelligence the White House did. The president, once again, is misleading America. And once again, the president is just not telling the truth about what we saw and didn't see. Now, you know, maybe the president and his administration didn't do their job and look at the intelligence that was available to them, but there are even facts that contradict that. And let me be specific. The White House has already admitted that the president told Congress and the American public in the State of the Union address that Saddam was attempting to acquire fuel for nuclear weapons, despite the fact that the CIA specifically told the administration three times in writing and verbally not to use this intelligence. Now, we Democrats didn't get that memo. We weren't told that they had a contrary point of view. The same thing is true with respect to manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons. The Air Force disagreed with that conclusion. We were never told the Air Force disagreed with that conclusion.
Well, as you probably know, Washington Post reporter Dana Milbeck was on the program yesterday, and he said that there was a 90 or so page report that was available to lawmakers before the vote. Only six members of Congress read this full report on intelligence, and in that report was a lot of this criticism of the war.
It did not contain those specific elements with respect to whether or not we were being misled or not misled on those subjects. It did not contain that information. Moreover, if I may say to you, the fact is that, you know, in other ways, the president also misled the country, because our vote was premised on the president's promise that he was going to exhaust all the remedies, that he was going to build a legitimate coalition globally, that he was going to go through the inspection process to the farthest degree, and he did none of those things. He truncated the inspections. In fact, Dick Cheney opposed them and was hoping they wouldn't get in the way of their pulling the trigger. And the fact is that we all now know that the president didn't do the planning that he promised. So, you know, our criticism is based on the fact that all of the stipulations made by the president were simply not kept, and that the president, in fact, misled the country not only on the intelligence, but on the manner and means by which he would go to war.
I'm talking to Senator John Kerry. And Senator, reports today, one in the Boston Globe, your home paper, say that your camp was actually happy to be singled out by the president in his Veterans Day speech because it puts you square on the radar, and that several recent trips to New Hampshire indicate that you're considering another presidential run.
That's so much silly talk. I don't know who would have suggested that in my office. That's not a conversation that I had with anybody. And I'm trying to help people all over the country, whether it's New Hampshire. I was campaigning for John Corzine in New Jersey. I was campaigning for friends who helped me in Iowa. I campaigned for the new mayor of St. Paul, Minnesota, somebody who helped me. You know, I think it's really important for us to do the grassroots building that continues the energy that was built up during the campaign. I'm proud of the campaign. I'm proud that people were elected all across the country and how close we came. And people want that energy continued, and I intend to continue it.
Well, Senator Kerry, we've got about a minute left, and we've been talking about many things, including pre-war intelligence and the call today in the Senate to at least have some information about a withdrawal from Iraq. And I'm wondering, you took a lot of heat from some of your constituents here in Massachusetts who were against the war and wanted you to vote against the war. What do you say to them now? And again, just about a minute.
I say to them that if we had known that the president was not going to keep his word, and that if the president had provided us the false intelligence at the time, obviously I don't think anybody in the I don't think there would have been a vote, and obviously I would not have voted the way that I did, and I regret enormously that the president has breached faith with us in so many different ways. And obviously that vote, I think every one of us who voted that way feels very badly about the way in which the president has let us down and let the country down in the process. Clearly, we wouldn't have had the vote if we had known what we know today. And knowing what we know today, I would clearly not vote the same way.
Senator John Kerry, a Democrat of Massachusetts, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. on a very busy day there. So, Senator, we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. You never know who the wind will blow in. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin.